Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Uh-uh, we got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
You're listening to Radio Basics, the radio wing of Basics Community News Services, bringing news from the people to the people on CHRY 105.5 FM. What up, Toronto?
Yes, Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5.
This is Kirthi, Kabir, and Nick in the studio today. How's it going, guys?
Okay, pretty good.
Real good.
Yeah,
we got an exciting show lined up for you today. A lot to
come. Yes, a lot to come. We're going to be talking about drone strikes in Afghanistan, all the way to... you know, the disintegration of the CFS.
Mm-hmm.
Long needed.
Long overdue stuff. So, this week basically marks, what, the 10th anniversary of September 11th?
Actually, it's the 12th.
Is it 12th? Oh, yeah, it's 12th.
Get it right, Kirthi.
Sorry, I can't do math.
Yeah, and a lot of things have happened since then, like a lot of excuses since September 11th for the increase of military interventions by the United States involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And actually also the anniversary of the coup in Chile.
Right. And that was in the 70s, right?
Yeah, it occurred in 73.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of background to it. And there was a lot of things going on that I was just reading in the book Killing Hope, which details a lot of CIA interventions.
In different countries?
Yeah. And it talks about how Salvador Allende was a progressive that the U.S. could not support. They wanted to get rid of him. It was during the middle of the Cold War. And there were many problems the Americans intervened in. And when they supported Pinochet, who came to power in 73, mm-hmm. that was a big problem for the Chilean people. There were many executions, many progressives, leftists, union activists, just people who were trying to build the society in general, were executed or imprisoned, tortured. And it was just a really bad time for Chileans, for the majority of Chileans. And so we remember those who were taken,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know what anyone else's thoughts are on that and the other American interventions that have come from that, but...
Definitely, I mean, well, tactically, of course, nobody here supports terrorism as a tactic, but, you know, we understand that this is what this kind of imperialism and colonialism breeds,
mm-hmm.
is this kind of resistance, especially when if you look at, I mean, if you take the official story at its word, you look at how the United States, part of their, you know, intervention in the Middle East has been to crush and decimate any kind of leftist movements. And so what you're left with is, you know, the kind of resistance that's engaged in reactionary tactics and is led by reactionary ideology, but nonetheless is engaged in resistance. And we need to make a distinction between the invasion and occupation of another country and the terrible crimes that are committed in the course of that action that's illegal from the start, and an act of resistance, which is still an act of resistance against imperialism. And I think the other thing that's interesting, Nick, when you bring up 9/11, is look at, you know, that event. We knew who was the number one enemy after that, right? Al-Qaeda, that name has become infamous, you know, throughout the Western world. Every, you know, that's the boogeyman, that's the devil, according mm-hmm. to, you know, the imperialist press and all these other people. And yet, if you look at who, you know, McCain and Kerry and these forces are now not only meeting with, but directly supporting, is Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the front there that is... one of the main factions in the resistance, so-called resistance in Syria, or one could call it the foreign-sponsored rebellion in Syria, or insurgency in Syria, is, an al-Qaeda operation in Syria, is the same so-called jihadist mercenaries that we saw, operating during the Kosovo War. So once again, the so-called enemy of imperialism, they're having to rely on it to defeat a greater enemy, which in this case is the alliance of kind of anti-imperialist forces such as Iran, Hezbollah, and Syria. They're having to rely on the same forces that attacked them, 12 years ago. So it's interesting, and I think it also shows somewhat the weakness of imperialism itself, that, as opposed to what, that book is an amazing book that you brought up. We look at the history of imperialist intervention. I mean, they used to be able to do these things by themselves. They didn't have to rely on a third party.
Mm-hmm.
If something was going wrong in the world, if anyone was exerting their self-determination or independence, any oppressed nation, any oppressed people was exerting that, the United States or Britain or an imperialist power themselves would go over and crush that, or have someone who was directly in their pocket like Pinochet. But we see now more and more and more, and you just need to look at someone like Karzai or, I forget the name in Iraq, but they're having to, rely on really whoever they can get.
Yeah.
And in many cases, that monster that they back bites the hand that feeds them.
Which is an echo back to, what happened in Afghanistan, sort of supporting the Mujahideen and the rise of the Taliban and, Bin Laden.
Mm.
Supporting these people just, to be a thorn in the side of the Soviets. People may not be aware that Afghanistan in the late 70s was actually one of the most progressive places in the entire region. Women had far more rights than in other places which were supported by the United States, such as Iran before the Islamic Revolution of 1979. People, the Americans supported Iran with the Shah, who was a brutal dictator and leader with brutal forces in Iran, but that goes back to the economic and ideological interests of the United States wanting to support countries which are pro-capitalist, pro-multinational investment, particularly American investment, but also other investments, wanting countries which are secure for business as usual versus anything out of the ordinary, even if it's a moderate challenge to imperialism. A moderate challenge is, in many cases, too much of a challenge.
So true, and I'm really glad you brought that up. From my understanding, even the female the literacy rate in Afghanistan at that time was even higher than some Western countries. It was a very that they destroyed and smashed, and that really needs to be recognized, that even the so-called all the things that they impose as characteristics of oppressed people or the third world, as if they're backwards or misogynistic or whatever we hear about the Islamic world, in many ways that was a colonial imposition and not in any way some kind of thing that was indigenous or natural to that region. These are colonial impositions. What we see throughout the Middle East and all the forces, even that are in some cases leading the resistance, this is a result of imperialist intervention and not the result of people coming to these decisions or ideas by themselves.
Mm-hmm. It harkens back to the joke of how did the Americans know Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons, because they had the receipts of they'd given Saddam these weapons because they wanted Saddam to fight again Iran. So we find a lot of these things going back to the same things. Why did they give support to Saddam Hussein in Iraq? Because they wanted him to be in against Iran, when there was a brutal war in between Iran and Iraq. But the point is that they don't have any rules about who they will and won't support. Basically, unless the person is helping the people in a socialist, democratic way, that's who they're not going to support. And they'll make allegiances with the devil from whatever side in order to overthrow that. That seems to be the pattern. It's like you could be pro-woman, you could be pro-literacy, you can be pro- all the things that the American government will say that they're trying to bring oh, we're trying to bring more understanding, and you know, we're trying to get women more involved in Afghanistan. Well,
then trying to liberate women. That's what they say. Even the Canadian government had the same stance about it, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're trying to liberate the women in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we're doing there.
Then why did they ever support the Taliban? How can you? It doesn't make any sense.
Or what does liberation of women mean when there's when there's bombs dropping on everyone's, you know, depleted uranium? That's not discriminating. I mean, that's women and children that are dying in those attacks. So you
disproportionately.
Know, exactly. And I think, I mean, we need to recognize the biggest. That, I mean, although oftentimes, you know, since imperialism, you know, how would we say it? Almost like subcontracts. It's killing to other people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the most direct atrocities can seem to be perpetrated by these individual dictators or mercenary fronts, as we see in Syria. But ultimately, imperialism is always the biggest, you know, it has been historically the biggest murderer, the biggest killer, the biggest oppressor of women. That's been the driving force. And, you know, as you mentioned, Nick, I think it's important to note that this hypocrisy that we're seeing in Syria, we see even the right wing, like, you know, I turn on Sun News every now and then just to kind of... it's entertainment, you know.
Just to raise your blood pressure.
Yeah, just to raise the blood pressure, exactly. But, you know, you see these guys. These guys hate the Syrian intervention, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they hate it as if this is some kind of either. I mean, the most extreme proponents of that is that, of course, Obama has some kind of secret agent, right, of some kind that's really Muslim or whatever the case might be. Or that he's just extremely naive and doesn't understand that, you know, he's being used by Al-Qaeda, right? And so we have that flip side to it. But really, as you said, the thing is not that somehow Al-Qaeda is, it's not the dog wagging the tail, or the tail wagging the dog, I should say. It's that American imperialism, any government that will facilitate, you know, the ongoing theft of wealth, in the serious case, you know, they just found a huge reservoir of gas just off the coast of Syria, right near in the Mediterranean, right near Lebanon. And in fact, Syria, the only port I believe that Russia has access to in the whole Mediterranean is in Syria. So there's a lot of geopolitical, the gas and all that from Iran and Iraq is going to, you know, flow through Syria. So there's a lot of reasons why they want the intervention in Syria. Well, and it has nothing to do with anything other than, like, whoever's going to transfer that wealth over to, you know, imperialist centers, they'll side with them, no matter what their policies are. And as we see, who are the biggest allies of the U.S. in the Middle East right now? Saudi Arabia, like the most backwards, probably, country in terms of social policies in the world. That's their ally in the region. And Israel, which in fact, just recently the other week, instituted segregated kindergartens in one of their major cities because of all the African migrants. So these are the countries that they're supporting the region. So let's not kid ourselves that they have any concern about any policy that Assad is putting in place.
Yeah.
Definitely.
All the hair, they don't have so very very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me. Change it, can't do it alone. Can't do it alone. Need some help, y'all. Can't do it alone. Can't do it alone. Yeah, yeah. Wake up, everybody. Wake up, everybody. Need a little help, y'all. Yes, we do. Need a little help. Say it for me. Need some help, y'all. Change the world.
So that song was called Wake Up Everybody by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. It's like an old classic song that I just played. I hope you enjoyed that. And now on the line with me, I have Ashley, a spokesperson from the Defederation CFS campaign. Hello, Ashley.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for joining us on Radio Basics today. So maybe you can just start off by talking about what motivated you to start this, defederation campaign, and maybe even explain a little about the CFS, because we have all sorts of listeners tuning in today.
Sure. So the Canadian Federation of Students is a largely a national and provincial lobbying organization that as student unions, many of us are members of. And the idea of the Canadian Federation of Students is that they are supposed to participate in mobilizing for protest and lobbying to the federal and provincial governments on our behalf. The reason that we've been brought to this point of launching this nationwide defederation campaign is, initially the identification that they are not effectively mobilizing students, nor do people feel that they are effectively lobbying on our behalf. But I think more fundamentally for us, what brought us to this point was in our attempts to reform the organization, make them more transparent, make them more willing to accept the will of students in directing their campaigns and directing their mobilization, we really hit a wall and we faced a huge amount of hostility and unreceptiveness to change. And when we looked back at the attempts to reform the CFS over the past decade, we saw that we were not the first student unions that tried to make these kind of changes. This has been happening for, every couple years, the same reforms have been brought forward, and we've seen no change. We've seen no large mobilizations of the student movement, and we're really hoping to change that.
Okay, Ashley, it's Nick here. I just thought I'd ask you who the coalition is made up of to the extent that it's, the people who are in charge of running it.
Sure. So we're a group of students who have been very dedicated to student organizing. A lot of us have been involved in trying to reform the CFS. A lot of us have been involved in trying to mobilize our student unions within CFS. And, at this point, we are made up of 15 locals of the Canadian Federation of Students across the country who have decided to initiate these defederation petitions.
Okay, and how would you describe the political affiliations of the different locals and how people make that up in terms of, is this a right-wing, left-wing, center, what would you say is the basic background of people involved in this?
Sure. So one of the main, one of the main strawman arguments that are brought out against us when we critique the Canadian Federation of Students is that, we're just a bunch of right wingers that are trying to destroy the student movement. And that's really an easy argument for the CFS to make. But I think what's harder for them to accept right now is that we really are a movement of left-wing student organizers who are finally coming out at this point saying the CFS is not a left-wing institution. Mm-hmm. They can argue that they're progressive, but they're certainly not left-wing. And, we're not just right-wing students that are trying to destroy the student movement. We're actually left-wing student organizers that are finally coming out and saying that the CFS can't take claim to being left-wing because they're not. And what we really need is a left-wing student organization across the country to help mobilize students.
So Ashley, when you mentioned, and even just reading the article that was on Rabl, written by yourself,
released by the
defederation. Can you maybe go through? I mean, you definitely went over it in the beginning a bit, but go through exactly what you mean. Especially, I mean, the part of the article that strikes me as a critique that we've definitely heard before and is an important one. When you talk about the lack of organizing and organizing tactics, if you can go into that a little bit more. So when you say the CFS cannot take claim to being a left organization, give us some examples of historically why you think that's been the case.
Sure. From my experience within the CFS, they really just hide behind, a handful of glossy materials that talk about how tuition should be lower. But what they really are is a staff-run organization, largely long-term staff who at one point may have been students, but at this point are just defending, their position as staff within the organization and nothing else. And one of the things that we've been trying to fight for in the organization is the ability of regular student members to actually affect the direction of campaigns, the topic of campaigns, and the tactics that are used in mobilization. And, you know, the CFS is completely unreceptive to that, because the truth is that it is actually, you know, the Canadian Federation of Staff. These are people who, above all else, just want to defend their employment. And, you know, the way that we see it, the only way to actually have a viable student movement in Canada is actually to have campaigns that are directed and created by students. And, you know, if they don't actually see that they have any ability to make decisions within this organization, they're not going to be contented with being handed a flyer and told to hand it out at Frosh Week, or being handed a flyer and being told to hand it out at a poorly attended, you know, Canadian Federation of Students Day of Action. What they really want is campaigns that they have voted on, that they have created themselves, and that they feel that they are directing, because they actually are. And it is my experience that that is completely impossible within the current formation of the Canadian Federation of Students.
So how do you vision a defederation really working out in a campus setting or within student organizing? I know you touched up on that a little bit, but maybe I think it would be a good idea to expand a little bit more on that. Like how, you know, I think it would be better if we could get a clear image of what exactly, you know, your vision is.
Sure. I mean, the defederation part is, it's certainly an uphill battle. So after, you know, after 12 or 13 locals in 2009 attempted to defederate from the CFS, the CFS was left with two options. One was to actually respond to the critiques of these students and change the federation, and the other was just to make it way harder to leave. And it turns out they decided to take the latter option, and what they did was they increased the threshold from requiring 10% of the membership to sign a petition to have a vote on membership to requiring 20% of the membership to sign a petition to have a vote on membership. They made it so that if you have one vote on defederation and people decide to stay with the Canadian Federation of Students, then you can't even hold another vote for 5 years. So rather than respond to the critiques of these student organizers in 2009 when they had their mass defederation campaign, they actually just made it even more prohibitively difficult to leave the federation in an attempt to basically force the maintenance of their membership. So in terms of leaving the federation, it's certainly an uphill battle. You know, I'm a member of the graduate students at the University of Toronto. And when you think about how many grad students are off campus at any moment of time, or out of the country at any moment of time, the idea that you need to collect the signatures of 20% of that membership, you know, hard copy signatures, just to even have a vote, is a pretty difficult thing, and a task that we were willing to take on because we do really believe that our members want to have this vote. But yeah, definitely just even like even making that democratic process happen of having a vote is an uphill battle. But whether or not we can actually manage to get through, you know, the legal swamp that's required to leave Canadian Federation of Students, our main priority is developing an organizing alternative. So, you know, we will certainly be attempting to go through all of the unreasonable bylaws of the CFS to legitimately have a defederation vote. But however that turns out, what we're going to be doing is, you know, dealing with the rank and file membership of the Canadian Federation of Students to build an actual mobilizing alternative where students can actually vote on issues, they can create their own campaigns, you know, people that represent them will actually be provided with mandates, as opposed to what you see in the CFS now, where you have a handful of national and provincial executives and a large group of long-term staff who actually determine the campaigns and then basically just distribute materials to you when you actually show up at one of their annual general meetings.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about and in terms of what the ultimate goal is or what the objective is, what in fact, you know, a real democratic student movement would look like, you know, it's interesting having this discussion now when we actually saw that you know, in the summer of 2012 in Quebec. And I'm wondering, you know, when I know a lot of discussions happen after that as to, you know, why is there not this kind of movement in the rest of Canada, right? And maybe, you know, if you can speak to that itself as to, you know, that being an example of something in which, whether it was the way in which decisions were made throughout that strike, even the militancy of you know, the demonstrations, their ability to mobilize people, how that differs and how, you know, that example differs from, you know, what we see with
the CFS. Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of us as leftists and as leftist student organizers were really inspired by what we saw in Quebec, and not just by, you know, the militancy or the messaging, but really by the numbers, right? Like the number of people that were actually brought into the street, the number of people that were really willing to go on strike. And, you know, particularly one of the notable things was the people who went on strike, or the student associations that went on strike, at places like McGill and Concordia, who had never participated in those Francophone struggles before in Quebec. And, you know, those are the schools that defederated in 2009. And one of the things that you'll find when you enter, you know, these CFS AGMs is really this idea that you need to be afraid of your membership, that we can't let people make decisions for themselves because they're going to make the wrong ones, and, you know, that the staff and the national and provincial executive of the CFS are really the ones who know what's right for students and know the right campaigns to put forward. And I think what happened in Quebec was really a great example of what can happen when you actually give power back to the people who are actually affected by it. And one of the things that you see through CFS is they really think, number one, their primary tactic is lobbying. But they're lobbying with no strength behind them, so they don't actually have the ability to mobilize students, because students see them as an illegitimate body. And students know that they don't have the power to make decisions in this organization. Students don't feel like these are their campaigns, and that's why they're not participating in the numbers that they did in Quebec. So, you know, I think that you can certainly see, like, militancy as an end goal, but I think what we really need to see in places like Ontario right now, in terms of the student movement, is a revitalization of the democratic process, a move towards direct democracy as much as it can happen, and the idea that students will actually be involved in campaigns if they have some say over them. And I mean, I personally am not afraid of the decisions that my fellow members will make. I think that, you know, we can argue about things politically, but fundamentally, to mobilize people, they need to be making decisions for themselves. And, you know, you're not going to get huge numbers out to a protest, let alone a strike, if people are just being handed a glossy flyer and told to accept the messaging and not participate in the creation of it.
Is there any, are there any ways where you've been questioned by others where you think that perhaps there are dangers in defederating, and that might be something that's useful to any right-wing or reactionary forces on campuses across the country? Because there are some clear reasons behind people's frustrations with the CFS, but is there any concern that in the vacuum of a defederation, other problems could be created? Where I'm not saying that the defederation effort is necessarily a right-wing backed, but are there not benefits for the right-wing in defederating?
I mean, that's certainly an argument that people make. I personally think that that's just the standard fear-mongering of the Canadian Federation of Students. I mean, I think one of the large misnomers that I've heard put out there is that this is somehow an attack against student unions. You know, I will say, like, I am a proud member of the U of T Graduate Students Union. I think they do great work. I think it's a really democratic student union, and I'm glad to have been a member of it. And, you know, defederating from the CFS, I think it's important we remember what the CFS is. So the CFS isn't a union. It really is a lobbying body that these unions pay into. So by, you know, by disaffiliating from the Canadian Federation of Students, we're not weakening our student union. And when people have said, you know, the CFS is keeping out the right or keeping out the right wing from our student unions, I'm not sure how they would be doing that other than if they are claiming that they're controlling elections, which is not something I would support under any circumstance. So, you know, that's, I think it's important to keep a perspective on what the CFS is. You know, the CFS is not a union. The CFS is an organization that lobbies on behalf of student unions, and the CFS is an organization that is supposed to organize unions, and is supposed to mobilize the members of unions, but that's not actually a thing that's happening. So, you know, it's unclear to me what people think, you know, this disastrous scenario would be without them. I think, if anything, the CFS is really having the effect of discrediting the left, because people see the general ineffectiveness of the CFS. People see all the controversies about the financial, you know, the questionable financial behavior of the CFS, and there have been a lot of accusations about the financial behavior of the CFS across the country for quite some time. And I think people see those things, and it makes them distrust the activities of the student unions more than anything else. But, you know, this isn't an act that I think would weaken our student unions at all. And I think really, you know, it would just clear some space for people to do some actual grassroots organizing, as opposed to just having these campaigns handed down to us. But, you know, if people are concerned about their health insurance, that's a thing that's actually provided by your local student union. That's not something that's provided by the CFS. And if people are worried about this lack of lobbying, you know, I think there's certainly other ways for them to do that. And when it comes to grassroots mobilizing, I think we really only can get better in that field if we don't have the CFS around to crush grassroots organizing efforts.
Now, Ashley, what do you say? I mean, obviously this is an important struggle unto itself. Would you say that it fits into a broader context, however, when you see, at least it seems to me, when you look at, for example, moves by the NDP recently, as, you know, exposing itself more and more as just a complete proponent of, you know, Canadian imperialism and things like that. You see the movement of, you know, some of the major unions that increasingly, you know, these institutions that have been traditionally seen as somehow progressive or, you know, left-wing, as you mentioned in the beginning, are really not that, and are really just kind of seem to be, again, enforcing or other organizations of, whether it's direct organizations of the state or just enforcers of the status quo, that this speaks to a larger trend of, you know, these social democratic institutions kind of showing themselves to be what they really are.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think that's actually a perfect example. So I think if, as leftists, we really want to see our movements move forward, we really need to look at our engagement in these organizations. You know, how many leftists have wasted their time trying to change the NDP, or how many leftists have wasted their time thinking that something revolutionary was going to come out of one of these very institutionalized organizations that weren't actually going to bring them anywhere. You know, I think that what we see with these organizations, like with the CFS, is they claim to be the left wing. And I do think it is our responsibility as left-wing organizers to actually call them on that. So, no, what the CFS is pushing for is not left-wing. That's not what I want for left-wing organizing. I don't want controlled, quote-unquote, democratic spaces where the decisions are made before members actually show up there. I don't want these institutions where the idea is that there's a handful of people that have the expertise to make the decisions about how all people should move forward. And I think that we do actually, we need, as the left wing, to start showing that these people are actually, at best, centrists, and nothing else. And I think one of the unfortunate things that came out in Ontario, you know, after the Quebec student strike, when student organizers in Ontario were like, well, how can we revitalize our movement? You know, they saw a lot of their time and energy wasted within the CFS. And I think that as leftists, we need to not be afraid to say what we actually need is a legitimately left-wing student organization. And, you know, if that means that not everyone wants to be members, that's actually totally fine. Like take a page out of ASSE. If you want to join this organization, then you need to agree to the basis of unity. And if you don't, then you shouldn't be a member. I think one of the things that has caused a lot of tension within CFS is they've really relied on this fact that, one, they want to force everyone to be a member. And they don't want to give people the democratic option to leave. And the reason for that is they've become so dependent on that money from those student dues, from the member dues, that they actually can't maintain their overhead without that membership. And I think when we're looking at a new organizing body, we really do need to be looking at minimizing that dependence on student money and maximizing the ability for those students to make decisions for themselves. And if we go forward in that way, then we can make it clear that you join this student organizing body if you want to organize in these ways, and if you agree to our basis of unity. And if you don't, then this isn't the organizing body for you. And I think, you know, what ASSE showed us in Quebec is that you can have less people, but people that are actually have a greater agreement about what they're doing, and that can be way more effective than having a larger group of people who, you know, are forced to be members of this group and don't even actually want to be participating and don't have any engagement in the decision making. So a smaller group of people that are more engaged and actually know what they're signed on to is a more powerful body politically than a larger membership that's forced to be there and either, you know, strongly wants to leave or doesn't care if they're there at all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much, Ashley, for joining us today. That was a very good discussion.
Is there any website you'd like to, or any information you'd like to put out there before we let you go, Ashley?
So at this point, the main thing that we're looking for is, you know, if you are on a campus where you want to start this process towards defederating from the Canadian Federation of Students, or if you're interested in finding out more information about a new student organization, you can email timetomobilize@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once we get through this petition drive phase, all of you will be hearing way more about our plans for a founding conference in 2014 of an actual leftist student organization that will begin to mobilize for the Canadian student movement.
Sounds great. Thank you very much, Ashley, for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Clash with police in Germany with the anti-fascists hitting the streets worldwide. The tide is turning, fires burning, versus workers in Cairo. Next thing we marching on Chicago. NATO, the hired gun, the banks running the G8. They can hide in Camp David, but their agenda ain't changed. War in the name of humane intervention, invented rebellions, hidden intentions, million invested in arms. They claim we not getting involved, but we already are. Disaster war makers is after all the last remaining natural assets, all under the sand in Iran. It's gonna be the same excuse, propaganda on the news, save the world from the nukes. Oh, it's gonna be a hot summer. Get your mother, get your young, get your block, make your mark, get involved, organize, hit the streets, march, protest, sing for a new beginning. It's the American spring.
Be prepared.
Never scared.
The end ain't near.
Nah,
we just getting started. I spit a freestyle, listening to the radio. What's the dial? It's 105.5. That's on FM, radio for the people. I fight against capitalism, cause capitalism is evil. Homie, I gotta speak it. The music, you need to face it. That's why I'm on the radio, listening to Radio Basics. This how we do this. I'm blowing up in Chicago. My rhyme's tighter than U.S. and Cuban embargoes. Sending the freestyle up north to North Canada. And everybody listening. And everybody know that my eyes still glistening. Spitting ill lyrics for the little children. Fight for immigrants. Y'all spitting gibberish. So I'm listening to the CHRY 105.5 FM, radio for the people. Peace out, y'all. This is Rod Stars.
This is G1, and we Rebel Diaz.
Rebel Diaz for the people, y'all. Peace.
So that was a stinger by Rebel DS.
Yes.
Love that stinger. So awesome. So we were actually just talking about drone attacks.
Yeah. Just casually discussing massive crimes against humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, I think, you know, off the back of our discussion about Syria, like, I know today, starting today, there's going to be, the Congress is going to be debating the decision. Obama's going to be making his latest appeal tomorrow. It's a huge appeal. He's doing interviews on, I think, almost every major network today. Again, pushing for the appeal, pushing for the strikes, the military strikes, and the
he's a salesman for the job.
Salesman, and it's interesting because, you know, at the same time that they're railing and ramping up about all the human rights abuses committed by Assad, just this weekend on Saturday, you had just the latest in really an ongoing campaign of terrorism and murder against you know, the people of Afghanistan by the United States. So maybe you can give us the details of that attack.
I can't give you the details of the attack, but I can, you know,
around 16 people were killed.
Yeah, 16 people were killed.
And I don't think people, like, when you say drone attacks, I mean, I think it's become such a casual thing to say these days, right? But, like, these are essentially, like, just bombs dropped randomly. You know what I mean? There's, like, no real target here but the people, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think in this case, they always claim a target. But I think the thing
but
is that,
like,
there's
in
no...
in reality, I'm talking about reality.
It's remote control. Like,
exactly.
It's a remote control, which even eliminates... I mean, this is the thing, and it's funny. You know, I had this discussion with someone recently when they were bombing Afghanistan, you know, during the initial invasion. Of course, this was an illegal war to start off. They were showing this on everywhere. Every network was showing the bombings of Afghanistan and Kabul and, you know, displaying these images. And then, you know, a few weeks later, months later, there had been a captive American who was beheaded by the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reaction in the media was, what a barbaric act, this beheading.
Right.
What a horrible act.
Mm-hmm.
And the reaction of this comrade who I was talking to was like, his reaction to that was, that's actually quite precise. I mean, minus whatever people might feel about violence or whatever, that's precise in terms of that kind of execution. When you're talking about bombing a city, one of the most, you know, densely populated places on the earth, that's the barbaric act. Like, that's in fact the definition of, you know, what you talk about, an inhumane or barbaric act of war.
Right.
And same thing with these, like, what could be more terrifying than, you know, bringing war to that stage where it's not even, they don't even want American, like, even this invasion of Syria, they don't want American lives even affected by this. They want this to be entirely Syrian casualties, entirely, you know, Pakistani and Afghan casualties.
And even during, like, speaking of which, even during, like, that attack on Iraq, I realized that a lot of the times the media, the way the media portrayed the attacks, like, they would show, like, you know, bombing in Iraq, you know, whatever, and then they would have all these lights go off, almost like it's like a festival or something, you know what I mean? The actual goriness or the gruesome attack, the brutality or the intensity of those attacks are not reflected in the media, right? Whereas if you show, oh, this journalist was beheaded, they would try to make it as gruesome as possible. So the effect on you psychologically is totally different, whereas you're just seeing, you know, a whole city being, you know, bombed during nighttime, which kind of looks good to your eyes, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas a man being beheaded, that, and they would actually show something graphic of, you know, when it comes to that American or whatever it is, and that the effect that has on someone's psyche is totally different, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, and we were just talking about that map, you know, the graph where when it comes to Pakistan, for instance, when Bush, I mean, I'm not by any means supporting Bush, but when Bush was actually in power, the drone attacks on Pakistan, there's a comparison between that and then what happened post-Bush, basically during Obama's time. And you could just see the graph just going crazy. Like, it's dot, 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 dots everywhere. And, like, it's just, it's crazy. And I think Obama's like a drone lover.
Yeah. Well, it's the U.S. imperial machine is, it has to have more sophistication in different times. The, like, September 11th, gave the military and gave the U.S. establishment and the powers the excuse they needed to ramp up the Patriot Act and, you know, putting people under repression at home while sending soldiers and building military machines abroad. Bush couldn't sell the American people like Obama did. Mm-hmm. But Bush didn't have to, because Bush had this terrible thing that happened. People got their fear went through the roof, so they could be more easily sold on things like the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, the Patriot Act, more Islamophobia and repression at home, the bases at Guantanamo Bay and everything that was going on there. Obama has to do a better sales job, and that's probably ultimately why the financial powers picked him and funded him so heavily to become the next president of the United States. Because in Obama, they saw, much like Clinton, a smooth salesman who could kind of sell you on things that, you know, to talk about, you know, progressive forces and all the people who got behind Obama expecting actual change and, you know, things to get better in the United States.
Yes, we can.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, what do we see besides? Has Obama gotten rid of the Patriot Act? No. Has Obama eliminated any of the military campaigns? No. He's increased them. And because he's a Democrat, and he, you know, the Democratic Party takes money from unions and other progressive forces who they misjudge the Democratic Party in thinking that it's going to be a good use of their time and their money and their investment. What Obama has done is he's made the left weaker in the United States, but maybe the left needed to see that happen with Obama in order to understand it. But, you know, how do we know how many people out there in the United States are truly disenfranchised or don't, you know, aren't happy with Obama? How many are still holding on to hope that he's going to turn things around, you know?
Even in Canada, the support for Obama is still, like, it's dwindling, but still it's there, right?
Definitely. And I think one important factor, that's definitely a correct point in terms of him being, you know, it's not even about him being the lesser of evils. He's the more effective evil.
That's what it is.
He is, plain and simple. Mm-hmm. And I think another huge factor is the fact that Obama's African. And the U.S. has definitely, if you look at neocolonialism in general and how that's operated, we know that colonialism, you know, we talk about this history of U.S. interventions in the world. They realized very quickly that it was a lot easier to put a black or brown or, you know, yellow face on, you know, whatever horrible things were being done in these countries, as opposed to just blatantly having it as, you know, a colonial occupation, that the people swallowed the pill easier, you know, it was easier to deceive people. And that's been really, as Kwame called it, Kwame Nkrumah, the last stage of imperialism is this phase of neocolonialism, of, you know, what some people have termed blackface on white power, or, you know, in terms of, or putting a so-called colonized face on imperialism. And Obama, I think the reason that he's able to go, like we see him in Africa recently, selling, you know, all these new AFRICOM and all these places, you're right, Bush would never in his life, not even Bush, but I don't even think Clinton would be able to do that.
No.
They need someone like Obama, even like if you look at internally the U.S.
versatile.
And all the anger after Hurricane Katrina, and even like this Trayvon thing, who was able to get on the airwaves and say, oh, the cars have been locked when they see me, and people have followed me around in stores before, and I've experienced racism too. So, you know, just calm down, everyone. Let's not take it to a next level. Obama was able to do that. And that's, I think, it was a huge factor in him being brought in, for sure.
Anyways, that's it for tonight, I guess. You know, and we'll be back next week. And if you guys have any feedback, want to show us some love, whatever the case is, you can always get in touch with us, radiobasics@gmail.com. Always feel free to check out our website as well, basicsnews.ca. We always have a lot of current articles and, you know, a lot of good stuff in there as well. So that's it for tonight.
Definitely.
Thanks for listening.
All right. So I'm going to leave you guys with a track called The Apology, and it's by Henny Jack, True Rest, Cardboard Kid, and a whole bunch of other artists that I just, I'm too lazy to read out. But anyways, enjoy this and have a good night. Peace out, Toronto.
In the 1870s, the federal government, to meet its obligations to educate Aboriginal children, began to play a role in the development and administration of these schools. Two primary objectives of the residential school system were to remove and isolate children from the influence of their home, family,
families, traditions, and cultures, and to assimilate them into the dominant culture. These objectives were based on the assumption that Aboriginal cultures and spiritual beliefs were inferior and unequal. Indeed, some saw it, as was infamously said, to kill the Indian in the child.
But I'm still alive and I will not die. I'ma do the impossible, looking to fly. With the eagle, condor side by side. The spirit stays strong, a spirit don't die. A lot of our youth wanna hang by the neck. What you expect, all you do is neglect. You apologize and you just forget. All you do is talk, come take a step. Six Nations, I'ma always rap. Yeah, Six Nations, I'ma always rap. North to the south, we must connect. East to the west, we must connect. When it comes to the feds, don't trust you yet. Don't hate you, don't love you yet. So enough with the talk, let's see some walk. You like to talk, here's some food for thought. Why do you think that all this exists? You wouldn't let those kids exist. You taught them about hating lies. You taught them about rape and crime. You pushed all that hate inside. So let's teach them that was made to fly. Genocide pain still aching on. 1492, we stay strong. 1890, we ain't gone. 2013, we'll be fighting long. Power to the people, empower the youth. Spread that knowledge so we reach the truth. I know it wasn't us who made this hustle, but we never back down in the face of struggle. Never back down in the face of struggle. Never back down in the face of struggle.
I mean, if you actually know what is in the Indian hand, I mean, if you actually really have read it and know what's in it, it's the most racist form of legislation that exists in the entire planet. It is the most racist.
And you're too damn late to apologize. More white lies to cloud our minds. We gotta open our eyes and realize it's time all people stand up, let's rise. Our side to shine, represent red pride. Umwe humwe, struggle nationwide. Keep your heads held high, don't forget the past. Cause through tough times we built the last.
My people stand strong throughout the ages. Seven generation overcome the hatred. Welcome to Canada's dark side. Our poor died while heart died. My grandmama, great-grandmama, beef for being Kanikihaka. And just last year she passed. So on her behalf, apology not accepted.
The poison injected, your devil infested. Core systems rejected, our spirits reflected. Our children molested, propaganda subjected.